Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 199 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the essayist Chris Arthur speaks with Cherise Saywell about the essay as a multifaceted and heretical form, the notion of a dangerously failed piece of work, and the encouraging fact that if you can find the objects that speak to you, essays will follow.
Chris Arthur is an essayist and poet. His work has been published in literary journals on both sides of the Atlantic, and he was one of five Ulster poets included in Largan Press's Poetry Introductions 1 in 2004. In this interview, we focus on Chris's essays. He has been working in this form for more than three decades. His collections include Irish Nocturnes, Irish Willow, Irish Haiku, Irish Elegies, On the Shore of Knowledge, and Reading Life. A new and selected essays volume, Words of the Grey Wind, was published in 2009. His 2018 collection is called Hummingbirds Between the Pages and is part of Ohio State University Press's 21st Century Essays series. His work has been included in the Best American Essays and frequently mentioned in the notable essays lists of this annual series. A member of Irish Pen, he's one of the writers included in Patricia Craig's landmark selection of writing for the North of Ireland, the Ulster Anthology, published in 2006. Chris's writing has received various honours, including the Akagarasu Higher International Essay Prize, the Munro K. Spears Essay Prize, and the Times Higher Palgrave Macmillan Writing Prize in the Humanities. I want to start by talking about how much I enjoyed reading your essays. It would be nice to talk about the form, about how you came to write essays. I don't know if you ever thought about writing other forms, poetry or stories. How did you arrive or become aware of the essay as a creative literary form?
Entirely by accident. I started as a poet, and for a long while that's what I thought I would do. And I wrote a lot of poetry. I toyed with fiction, not very happily. And then one day, browsing in an Edinburgh bookshop, quite by chance, I came across a copy of the 1989 issue of Best American Essays. And the Best American Essays is a series that's published every year, starting in 1986, general editor Robert Atwan. And it's still going today. And for whatever reason, I thought the book looked interesting, and I bought it, and I read it, and I was, as they say, blown away by it. I just thought it was fantastic. I had no idea that you could do the kind of things with short pieces of prose that the assembled writers in Best American Essays 1989 were doing. And it inspired me. I started to write essays myself, and I then had what I would wish every writer to have. I had a crucial piece of beginner's luck in that the first serious essay that I wrote, the first one that I was pleased with and sent off for publication, I sent it to a journal in the States called The American Scholar, which at that point was edited by Joseph Epstein, who was an essayist whose work I admired. He was in Best American Essays 1989, and I'd subsequently gone on and read several of his collections of essays and thought they were really, really fine. What I didn't know at the time was that The American Scholar takes, on average, 4% of the submissions that it's sent, unsolicited submissions. So I blithely sent off this essay called Ferio, and it was accepted, and it was rewarded handsomely. They pay well. And I got very enthusiastic reader response, including an approach from a New York literary agent asking if I had a book. And I think that had a big impact because I was just starting out with the form. I was just experimenting with it. And that gave me really positive feedback. You know, that was exciting. For a kind of first-time essayist, that was really good. So I wrote more. And started placing them in a range of journals, and that's what I've continued to do, using that as the platform to publish books. Because, of course, the nice thing about essays is that you can publish along the way. Unlike the novelist, you know, struggling with a kind of vast tome, I can publish essays as I go and get responses from editors and from readers, and then think about putting the thing together as a book.
Much like with short stories,
yes.
I thought. Yeah, I felt
absolutely.
When I was reading your essay about being an Irish essayist, I think you had talked about a definition of the essay that it seemed to me to have a lot in common with the short story form, where they're designed to be read in one sitting. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Well, what you say about that immediately reminds me of Michael Holroyd's comment. Holroyd said that an essay is a non-fiction short story. And I think there is, yes, a lot in common between the two, which is not to say that I think that I could write short stories. I don't think I could. My efforts in that direction are not... it's not a form that I really want to write in, but I can see the parallels.
Particularly in the way you can read them in one sitting and then return to them, because that was definitely the sense I had reading your essays. I would sometimes linger on a sentence or a paragraph, or I would return to an idea, go back to the start of the essay and have a look at an idea that you had started working with. I had a sense that I wanted to return to them and see how you wove these ideas together. How long does it take you to write an essay?
A long time. I mean, it's of course difficult to say, you know, when does an essay begin? When does any piece of creative writing begin? Very hard to actually put your finger on the moment that it starts and then the moment that it ends. But I would say, as a rough indication, I mean, we're talking months for an essay. Occasionally, something will happen and gears will shift and I'll be able to write something much more rapidly than that. But by and large, I like to think in terms of a period of months. Mm. It takes me a long while to work up from the initial drafts to something that I'm happy to leave. I think also what you're saying about going back and reading an essay again, there are such different styles of reading. And I think, to an essayist's disadvantage, a lot of people these days expect to open a book at page one and read through to the end. Essays are not really like that. With my books of essays, you can probably start anywhere. I try to arrange them in a way that makes sense of how they evolved, how they work together. But realistically, essays are independent pieces, and they should be able to stand on their own. So in any of the collections, although I would like to think of the ideal reader starting at page one and going straight through to the end, there's no reason why you shouldn't start with the last essay, go back to the first essay, do it whichever way you like, meander through. And meandering is very much something that the form likes in any case. I think it was David Robinson in The Scotsman, who's been a valued supporter of the kind of writing that I do. David said to me once that he thought there should be a warning printed in my books to only attempt a single essay at a time. And he said that way he finds them, you know, a really rewarding thing to read, but that he wouldn't recommend reading the book through at one sitting. He thinks, take it an essay at a time, think about it, go back to it. But I think if I printed that on the outside of the book, my publishers might have something to say about it.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about the genesis of your ideas. I have a friend who's a poet, and she said she gets a feeling when a poem is going to happen. She said she can feel it as if it's approaching her. Do you recognise it when it's happening?
That's an interesting question. It's hard to give a clear answer to that. A lot of my essays begin with objects, and I guess I've developed a kind of sensitivity to when an object is likely to result in an essay. It doesn't always shout out that it's going to do that, but some objects you just know. I mean, some objects are just overflowing with fascinating stories that just need to be told. Possibly the best example of that was a Japanese temple bell that I found in a junk shop in County Antrim, dating from, I think, 1807. It was manufactured in Japan. it was simply being used as a doorstop in this junk shop, but I happened to recognise what it was, and I negotiated a price and bought it. And I was able to find out a little bit about the bell's history in Ireland. I discovered that it had hung for a long while in a Chinese moon gate in a house in Hillsborough in County Down, which sounds unlikely but is true, and that when it was sold from there, records of the sale, records of ownership, were stored in an auction house in Belfast, and unfortunately it fell victim to terrorist firebombing, so I couldn't delve any deeper into that. But when I had the translations of the inscriptions on the bell translated into English, I was able to establish where it had been taken from in Japan. And it had originally hung in a temple called the Temple of the Lotus in Hiroshima Prefecture. And everything about that large metal object simply made me want to tell, well, not just its story, but what it represented as well. What it said about human endeavour in terms of peacefulness and spirituality and war making, because it seems very likely that the bell was taken as a souvenir at the end of the Second World War by an Irish serviceman, brought back to Ireland, where it had a brush with the Troubles. And I had the great pleasure of being able to send that object back, and it now hangs again in the temple that it was taken from, which was very satisfying, very pleasing to be able to do that. But I knew almost from the first moment that that bell came richly laden with Essie material, and that I knew with certainty, as soon as I saw it, an alien object in a very unlikely setting, I knew that that would be something that I'd want to write about. And quite often, objects are simply demanding that the essayist talks about them. I think it was the 19th century Scottish essayist Alexander Smith who said, if I can get this right, and it may not be an exact quotation, but he said something like, the world is everywhere whispering essays, and one only needs to be the world's amanuensis. Now, I don't think it's as simple as that. I certainly don't think I just have to sit down with my paper and pen and take down what the world is saying, but there's an element of truth in that. And if you can find the objects that speak to you, essays will follow.
I'd quite like to talk about nationality and Irishness, actually. I read your essay and a lot of the things you said about being an Irish essayist and about not belonging necessarily in one place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was prompted to think about this because I was asked to write a piece for the International Essayists column of the Essay Daily blog. And the editor of that blog said, could I reflect on national traditions of essay writing? And the main reference volume for the essay as a genre is a fascinating book called The Encyclopedia of the Essay, edited by Tracy Chevalier. And you can find articles in that encyclopedia about the English essay and the Canadian essay and the French essay, obviously, all sorts of national traditions. There's nothing about the Irish essay, of course, although there are quite a few individual Irish essayists mentioned. But it got me to thinking about, you know, what does it mean to describe yourself as, in my case, an Irish essayist? Because that's quite often how publishers will describe me or how reviewers will describe me. Of course, being from Northern Ireland means immediately a kind of conflicted sense of identity, because, you know, it can be a multiple thing. You know, are you Irish? Are you British? Are you from Northern Ireland? Are you Ulsterish or whatever? And I started looking into different essay traditions and different essayists. And I suspect that from a kind of literary critical standpoint, academics may stake out territories of the English essay or the French essay or the American essay. I'm not convinced that there's any massive difference. I think it's much more a case of individual style. I defy someone to read several different essays that are supposedly representative of national traditions and be able to tell which traditions they were from. So I would see my loyalty to the essay as opposed to the Irish essay. So I'm suspicious of national traditions, I think. I'm suspicious of being confined to something that says that's the territory you belong in and don't stray out of it. Because I think the essay by its nature as a heretical form and likes to stray and likes to go in places where it's not supposed to.
Tell me more about it as a heretical form.
Well, I guess I'm taking that point. A famous theorist of the SE, Theodor Adorno, said that the law of the innermost form of the SE is heresy. I think this idea of heresy, of not conforming to convention, of going where the essayist wishes to go, is very much to do with the heart of the form. And another theorist of the essay, Graham Good, says at the heart of the essay is the voice of the individual. And individuality is not going to be confined by particular rules or regulations or conventions. I mean, I call myself an essayist. I think I write essays. It's not as if I have a sense, really, of what that form is. If suddenly in an essay I think I need to break into verse, I'll do that. If suddenly I think I need to, you know, tell a story or look at a character or bring in a philosophical idea or stray into history, I'll do that. It's in order to get the piece to work in the way that I want it to work, so that it's speaking in my voice. I don't think there are hard and fast rules for essayists to obey. I mean, usually it's a shortish piece. Usually it has a sense of structure, a sense of form, but it's risky to try and predict what it's going to look like.
I think they have a very meditative quality, your pieces, and it would be nice if you could talk a little bit about that. There's a kind of a sense of interconnectedness about lives and moments in time and history that you seem to address in lots of your pieces.
Certainly connection is hugely important. I mean, to some extent, I guess my essays are about exploring connections and some quite unlikely connections. I have long been fascinated by the way in which life can just turn on tiny moments, and if things had changed millimetrically, everything would be different. Everything would be different. And for some reason, I find that fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
And frightening sometimes.
And frightening, yes, desperately frightening. And just the sheer unlikeliness of any of us being who we are, where we are.
When we are, yes. Could you talk a little bit about how you work with metaphor and how you decide on which metaphors you'll work with?
Well, I have no idea where metaphors come from. I would love to know, because they are so important. I mean, it's how we understand the world, essentially. But I know that when I'm writing a piece, if I get hold of a metaphor that works, that is the right one, that casts light on a point, that's when a piece really takes off. If a metaphor doesn't work, you've got to get rid of it, obviously. But as to where they come from, I just don't know. To some extent, if you're writing lots of essays, you're almost like a kind of metaphor generating machine. You keep on thinking of them and sifting through them and thinking, does that one work? Does that one work? And when you come across the one that does, it is so evident and endlessly diverting to see where it takes you. Because again, with metaphors, there's the element of the unexpected, because it is making a comparison. It is linking two things together in ways that you haven't thought about before. And you just don't know where that linkage is going to take you. And I think part of a successful essay explores that linkage and follows it and takes it in different directions.
Are there intersections with memoir in what you do?
Well, again, I'm happy to leave to literary scholars the business of defining genres and separating out what's memoir and what's essay and what's personal essay and what's reflective essay and what's lyric essay and what's creative nonfiction. I mean, really, I don't care. I just like writing the things. Mm. And if they tread on the toes of different genres, I don't care. What matters to me is the integrity of the piece and whether it works, whether it gets to that voice inside that's telling you what it is that you actually want to say.
Tell me a little bit about crafting your work, because your sentences feel they feel crafted, they're measured, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, crafted sometimes seems to me like a kind way of saying you had great difficulty writing that, and that essentially your first 10 efforts were inarticulate and they didn't work. And if that's what crafted is, then yes, I put up my hands to that. It takes me a long while to get a sentence that I'm really happy with. And I'm happy to work at it, to shape it, to try and try it out in different forms. I'm not sure if that's crafting or pig-headedness or determination or what, but it's just the process that I use to get there. I wish it was easier. I mean, I wish that I had the fluency, that I could just pick up the pen and write, and that was it, you know, first draft, but it never happens that way. You might get a sentence or two that it works like that, but in terms of the overall piece, there is so much scoring up and starting again and working through. But I mean, I don't need to tell you this.
No, I think crafted just means finished, actually.
Yeah, or abandoned. You know, that's as much as I'm prepared to do, and that's as good as I can get it, you know, and that's it. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of essays in the bottom drawer, things that haven't worked or that you've put away?
I think one of the few things that I've learnt as I've written essays is to know if something isn't working quite soon so that I don't waste effort on it. But that said, there are a few pieces that I wanted desperately to make them work. And yes, they lurk in a bottom drawer or in an obscure computer file. And I know that I should leave them alone. I know that they're the kind of writer's equivalent of a black hole that just pulls you in, and that I have gone as far with them as I can go, and that to try further really is a waste of time and effort. And yet I find myself reluctant to completely trash them. I kind of think, well, maybe at some point I'll clear that hurdle, I'll be able to do something with that piece. But there are a handful that I think realistically are failed pieces, and dangerously failed in that they will pull more energy in if I look at them. Mostly now I think I recognise that danger before it develops far. And if I'm committing time to something, I'm reasonably confident that at the end of the process I'll have something that I feel is finished.
There were a lot of birds in your essays. There are images of birds, birds, bones, and yeah, I wondered, do you have a special, like a real affinity with birds?
Yes, very, very, very definitely. I used to work in a nature reserve on the shores of Loch Ness. I was employed by the RSPB to be a warden there. And I've been interested in birds really since I was no age at all, and had the very great good fortune while I was at my first school to have as my biology teacher someone called Arnold Bennington, who was one of Northern Ireland's foremost naturalists. He wrote articles for the Irish Naturalist Journal. He was an avid ornithologist. He took expeditions to Iceland to study jar falcons. He was interested in all sorts of aspects of the natural world. He made a butterfly garden in the school grounds. He ran a school taxidermy club. And he infused me with his love of sparrowhawks. And I guess not surprisingly, given the role that birds have played in my life, they surface in the essays. And a lot of the essays make symbolic use of birds.
One more thing I wanted to ask you. How do you decide the order of your essays in a collection?
That's really difficult. The right order, when you find it, is it announces itself. It's evident. When I'm starting to put an essay collection together, I draw up a kind of short list of pieces that might go together. It's usually very clear what works as a collection and what doesn't. And then within that, if you shuffle around different possible combinations and different patterns, again, the one that works is really fairly self-evident. But I do experiment with different ways of doing it. I had a second piece of beginner's luck with the first publisher that I worked with on an essay collection. A small publisher in the States called the Davies Group, with a superb editor, with a real feel for essays. And the manuscript that I sent in the first instance was desperately unwieldy. You know, this was my initial attempt at a collection of essays. And I owe a great debt to my editor at the Davies Group, who said to me, she said, "Chris, you know, I really like this, but what you've sent me is two books, not one book." And when she said that, it fell into place. And it was indeed two books, not one book. In fact, it became three books. But that was a crucial piece of advice.
Do you work very closely with an editor on the individual essays? Are they quite polished by the time your editor sees them?
They tend to be polished. I've been enormously fortunate in that some of the journals that I publish individual pieces in, some of the editors that I'm dealing with have been very supportive of my work and very generous with comments in terms of what they think works, what they think doesn't work. So by the time I arrive at a book publisher, in a sense, I've already been through an editorial process because a lot of the pieces have appeared in literary journals. Now, fair enough, some editors, it's just a take-it-or-leave-it approach, but the ones that I like to work with, they give some degree of feedback and in some cases have suggested quite significant editorial modifications. One journal in particular I can think of, the editor is expert at taking out large chunks and rearranging things. And the first time I worked with him, I thought, no, absolutely not. But I've learned that he's got a very good eye for how things can be arranged differently. And I've, again, learned quite a lot from that.
I remember sharing a story to a friend who's also a writer and translator. And this opening paragraph that was there and had been there from the start and was genesis of the idea for me of the story. And she said, Charisse, I don't know why you've still got this here. The story doesn't need it. And I took it out and, oh my God.
Yeah, it's fantastic when someone makes a suggestion like that. Something you'd never think about really yourself. You know, like take out this entire middle chunk. And, you know, initially I think, no. You know, you're resistant because it's such pain to actually put the damn thing together.
Okay, shall we wrap that up there? I really enjoyed talking to you.
I enjoyed talking to you.
That was Chris Arthur in conversation with Charisse Sewell. You can find out more about Chris on his website at www.chrisarthur.org. And that concludes episode 199, which was recorded by Charisse Sewell and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 200, Anita Mason takes us to a tiny house in the west of Ireland to escape the world, and Duncan Forbes shares his own small and well-gardened corner of it in the fourth instalment of our Location and the Writer series. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.